Happy nurses equal happy patients on Insights in Nursing. Good day and welcome to another episode of Insights in Nursing. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and we're back with another great episode. We have some awesome panelists on the call today, including Kelly Arashin from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Kelly, welcome to the show. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Jamie. I'm Kelly Arashin. I'm a clinical nurse specialist in critical care and an acute care nurse practitioner. Yes, I live on Hilton Head Island. I blog as Barefoot Nurse, and I can't think of anything else to say about that, myself.
And that's okay. That's great. We're also joined by Terry Schmidt from at Online Nursing on Twitter and also from nursestory.com. So welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thank you, Jamie. It's always good to be here.
And we've got Victoria Powell from VP Medical back with us. How you doing, Victoria?
I'm doing great, Jamie. Thanks so much.
And thank you for, I think everybody had computer issues today, but we were able to connect some folks by phone, some by Skype, but it all worked out. Let's go ahead and jump on in because everybody is just hopping busy today. And I want to make sure we get through as much as possible in this episode. I want to start off with a link that Victoria, I think, sent my way. And it had to do with devices. Now, the article's all on Medscape. So those of you out there that are not on Medscape or have forgotten your password to Medscape, Terry, we're going to go ahead. You can go ahead.
I'm not saying a word. Continue.
It's okay. You can log in and get a free login over there, and then you can find these articles. I'll have links to them so you can find them yourself. But there is an article there that's I guess it's Topol, on five devices physicians need to know about. But, I think these are also devices in many cases that nurses need to know about. That's nurses all the way up through nurse practitioners, especially, I think, in some cases, nurse practitioners. And, Victoria, you sent this my way. Why don't you just kind of give me your impressions off the top of your head?
Well, of course, I'm a gadget girl, so I'm all about some apps and smartphones and all that kind of thing anyway. And then, in addition, I actually got to participate in some articles for the American Association of Nurse Life Care Planners, where we looked at apps first for the nurse entrepreneur who was in business for themselves and kind of just productivity-type apps. And then we also looked at apps for some of our patients, particularly for assistive devices and things for, let's say, the cognitively deficit patient, like in a brain injury and so forth. So I've been researching apps for quite some time, and I'm seeing that the physicians, by using their iPhones and so forth, are getting very used to using these kinds of things in the field, where overall our medical society as a whole, not the physicians, but the medical society as a whole, tends to be a little lagging behind. In one of these articles, the one that talks about the five devices, the doctor who is involved in that, little video or whatever he gives there, actually wrote a book, and what was it called? The Constructive Destruction or something of Medicine. What is it, Jamie?
I believe it's the creative destruction of medicine, which is interesting.
The creative destruction of medicine. He said this is the first book that he ever wrote to the general public rather than to medical as a whole, because he said that we carry our smartphones with us all the time, and that has become part of our DNA, where we are attached to our phones and we're starting to use them more often. So even though medicine is behind, what he's actually doing is he actually wrote this book to the consumer so that the consumer then will take this information and say, hey, I know you can do this with your phone. And it was different devices, like to check your glucose level, to check your heart rate, some of them are continuous monitoring. There's one device that's kind of like a Holter monitor, where they actually wear a strip for a week and then they turn it in and they get a new strip turned back into them, kind of like he describes it as the Netflix of cardiac monitoring. So he took that to the actual public so that the public can see what we have at our disposal to use if the medical society would hold on to this information. So we have everything from productivity tools for us as individuals to the, swing to the other end of the spectrum for ongoing medical monitoring, if you will, kind of telehealth type devices that have gone from the unit sitting in your home to the unit sitting in your hand.
And Kelly, you were talking before we got started that, you know, you're hopping busy today and because of some things going on in your ICU, would it be very helpful to you if you were somewhere else and had an iPad with you that you could monitor ICU patients directly from your iPad wherever you were?
Oh, absolutely. If I'm in another unit, you know, making rounds and the nurse calls me and says that, you know, a patient in the unit is changed rhythms or has unstable vital signs or whatever the case, and I can just call up that patient and look at the rhythm myself, they can send me the ECG or any other clinical information. That would be very time consuming. I mean, I don't work in a gigantic hospital, but it would sure beat running, you know, through the halls, down steps and all that kind of stuff if it's, you know, not urgent or critical. Certainly would be a very useful tool to aid in trying to give some orders or make a clinical assessment or a judgment over the phone. Absolutely. I can definitely see it used in practice. Absolutely. Excuse me.
Terry, what about primary care? This seems like a very interesting option for primary care physicians, too, and primary care nurse practitioners. Certainly, you know, we've seen the studies that have said that nurses are very good at monitoring patients with chronic health issues. One of the things that helps with that kind of monitoring is, you know, the daily weigh-ins that patients with CHF have to do to monitor whether they're retaining fluid or not. The you know, all that information that can be collected and sent, and how quickly you could scroll through a group of patients using an app like this, or perhaps have it set up so that patients with certain outside of norm signs show up at the top of your list. You can review and reach patients before they have a 911 call or before they even call your office. You have somebody reach out to them and say, hey, you know, we'd like you to come in.
I think that's a great idea and a next step. And so what's going to have to happen, because we don't want patient records and stuff not behind the firewall or not integrated into the electronic health system, is that those people who create electronic medical record systems are going to have to work with these app companies and allow that data then to be fed back. So, like, it would be great if my patient was tracking all their daily weights in my fitness pal or something, and then they gave me access to see that. I think the field is wide open for that. But I know, even practicing in rural America, having some of these apps at just in my pocket, you know, we talked before about whether a nurse should even carry their phone into a room or not, but I always keep mine in my pocket because my calculator's on it, my Hippocrates is on it to look up drugs. But here, let me just plug in and run an ECG with my smartphone or test your blood sugar. I don't have to go back out and get another monitor. I think that's pretty darn cool.
That brings up a new thing. You know, for me, you know, I work for myself. I'm out of the hospital. I don't have anyone telling me what I can and cannot do. So I'm not subjected to things like the hospital bureaucracy or getting in and out of the system, you know, like you were talking about. So that's something that I really hadn't thought about. I mean, I guess it is in the back of my mind, but, you know, maybe that's one reason that medicine is not as quick to change, is because they see it as an overwhelming process when you have the general public making these apps that are extremely useful. But just like when you go to download an app on your own smartphone, I mean, you're at a risk of a security issue when you do so. You've got to know who the app manufacturer is and is it trustworthy and so forth. And when this is an open platform like the Android system and you have all of these app developers working on this, I can see where that could be a real issue.
Definitely. You know, we were talking a little bit the last time we were on the podcast, and I had heard a little story on NPR or some talk radio about that, that, you know, medical apps are not regulated by the FDA or any kind of oversight. And, you know, that starts to just kind of raise a few questions. You know, you don't want it overly regulated because then it slows the progress down and the rate in which new technology can be developed and put out there to the general public and for healthcare providers is greatly slowed. But on the other hand, you don't want an app or technology out there that's putting patients at risk or is faulty or is made by people that don't understand the clinical disease processes or, you know, haven't done their due diligence. So, you know, it kind of is a double-edged sword because you want a quality product and you want it fast and there's a demand, you know, there's a whole supply and demand and people will, you know, you build it, they will buy it. But at the same time, you have to, you know, maintain some type of integrity of the product. So I think it's kind of a little bit of an uncharted territory. And then, of course, in the acute care world, and I'm sure it's still in the primary care world, you definitely have to worry about compliance issues and ethical issues and privacy. Certainly, you know, we get all in a tiz when a fax or medical records or anything else ends up in the wrong hands. Certainly don't want medical data, ECGs, blood sugars, or any other personal data going to the wrong person or getting wires crossed or anything that could be bad too. So I guess there's some other things that need to be worked out before mass production or we start adopting all these new technologies.
Which is where I can see this doctor going to the general public because, yes, you like you said, they're not FDA regulated or anything, which, you know, can be a good thing and a bad thing, depending on what we're talking about. But,
right. When is it a medical device versus just an app that's a calorie
exactly.
counter or tells you how much water you need to drink and, you know, how many, you know.
Well, as a primary care, how many times do you give somebody something to do on their own, like track their blood pressure or their blood sugar or whatever, and
exactly.
they don't do it? You know, they're not compliant. So if we have it on our smartphone, maybe we increase compliance.
Well, and there is some research to validate that, but, you know, Dr. Topol, however you say his name, I'm sure, just slaughtered it, and he's going to listen and then write me a nasty email. But he had done research on that pocket ultrasound that he had, which I think is so mm-hmm. cool because I work in rural health and we never have an ultrasound when we want it. And
right.
they published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and this is exactly what we should be doing. So we don't practice without evidence, and this is where nursing and healthcare research needs to go because we've got to decrease costs, we've got to increase access. And so apps like this, I mean, if you could carry your ultrasound machine and your EKG and your blood pressure in one pocket, your blood sugar check and all of that in one pocket, the other pocket's your stethoscope. You know, we used to tell nurses, you never come to clinical without your watch or I'll send you home, your watch and your stethoscope. And
right.
so now it's going to be, don't come to clinical without your smartphone. And that is where we need to be heading with this.
And I love that.
But in conflict, there's hospitals that are now, you know, limiting, especially bedside nurses, their use of their smartphone at the bedside. And, you know, it's again, one or two bad apples spoil the bunch because some people are texting or taking inappropriate pictures where other people are looking at drug dose calculations or, you know, looking up disease processes or accessing evidence-based medicine databases like the Lippincott, there's a new Lippincott, Nursing Advisor database that you can get oodles and oodles of evidence-based practice and literature and all kinds of stuff when institutions get a subscription to it. So, you know, it's where hospitals and practices draw that line. It's that fine balance between regulation and access and oversight.
Well, part of the problem is that these nurses, you know, the nurses that are using those tools at the bedside are often doing so on their own initiative. They're working, they're using their professional responsibility, as they should, to do what they need to do to become better nurses and provide for better patient care and better outcomes. And they're using those tools to make sure that they do that, to avoid medication errors, to make sure that they're up to date and doing best practice. That, you know, if the facilities themselves would get on board with providing the tools that really are useful to do this kind of thing, there wouldn't be a problem with, you know, secondary use or personal use. But I can see where that's a problem, but that's also a question of professional responsibility. Those people are going to do something.
Yeah. Hey, Jamie, how useful would all those devices be, like, say, for, you know, these rural fire departments and paramedic squads that are out there, and they just have a smartphone app, and I can run an EKG, and I can check a blood sugar, and I can ultrasound your heart all in one step.
There are some places that are doing just that. Let's see, Winnemucca, Nevada, Humboldt General Hospital. Their EMS department has ultrasounds on their units. They have a port. They have the iStat portable labs on their units. They're running troponins on cardiac patients in the field and transmitting them so they can get the information to the hospital that much faster. That's something that is happening, and that's a very advanced system there, where they have some forward thinking administrators that are looking at long transport times and things like that. But, you know, they're getting results in a rural area that you don't normally see outside of major metropolitan response zones, because they are using these types of tools. And you're right, rural nurses, rural primary care providers of all types could have a practice that is, these devices aren't that expensive. I mean, you know, you're talking about an iPhone and an add-on device that is a lot cheaper than what a full ultrasound machine would be. And it doesn't provide the exact same tools, but it provides you a look, you know, to make a decision of, you know, we don't have to send somebody by helicopter to a trauma center when we only suspect a GI bleed. We can look and see if there's a GI bleed. And if there's not one, they can go to the local hospital. Those types of decision making are happening in the emergency sector, and they certainly can be happening in the primary care sector, along with the monitoring and everything else. It just, you know, we are on the cusp of some very exciting changes, and the argument that security is a problem, I think, is spurious. I really don't think it's real. You know, there are a lot of people that say we can't use this tool, we can't use that tool because of security and patient confidentiality. A lot of people say that about Facebook and Twitter, but the FDA itself and Health and Human Services have said that the direct messaging capacity on those channels is compliant with private patient conversation.
Well, the same thing came out when HIPAA was starting to be enforced, and people were afraid that they could not call a patient's name out in the lobby to call back to the waiting room. I mean, we took it to the extreme, and it took a lot of education before that started being loosened up a little bit, till they realized that this is ridiculous. You know, calling a patient's name is not a violation of HIPAA.
Especially when you're sitting out in a public waiting room.
Right.
You're already visible. You're there.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Especially in a small town, everybody knows everybody. I can't tell you how many times I take my daughter for lab work, and
so
it's like,
how else
are
they supposed to get your attention or bring you back or call? You know, I totally agree. It's like at some point you have to draw a line and say, okay, we're doing every step imaginable to protect the patient's dignity and their rights and their privacy, but this is as far as we go. I mean, we can make ourselves crazy.
Well, and HIPAA, you know, HIPAA, even in the very beginning, said all of that. I mean, if somebody just bothered to look at it, the information was there saying, you know, incidental disclosure of patient private information is covered, is allowed, you know, such as being adjacent. And they covered things like, you know, being on the other side of a curtain in an ER, you know, take steps, don't yell it out loud. But if you're talking in a conversational tone and people on your side hear you, that's the nature of where you are. You know, so I think that you're right. It's just misunderstanding it. And I think that the security issue is really people that don't understand, Perhaps they think it's going to cost a lot more than it is. Perhaps they don't understand it. But most of these devices, even on an open system like an Android phone, there are ways to provide certificates when downloading apps and sending apps securely that can be utilized to protect the patient and protect the patient information. And that has to be done on our end. It's up to the patient to maintain the security on their end. We can give them a secure system, but if they opt to, have a virus on their system, it's not on their computer. It's nothing we can do about it if they email us information and it gets hacked by somebody else. I mean, that is, that's an unfortunate side effect of everyone having a computer. But as long as our side of the system is secure, we can protect patients. So what about this article that everybody's been talking about it, about the University of Pennsylvania study looking at burnout being a cause, nurse burnout being a cause for infections, hospital-acquired infections, and other negative outcomes for patients, basing this on nurse staffing, saying nurse-to-patient staffing ratios that are too low cause the nurses to become burned out faster, and burned out nurses are under so much stress that they start making mistakes by default. I'll ask Terry to go ahead and jump in on this one.
Okay. Well, I think my comment was, yeah, can you imagine what dinner's like at home too? We know these nurses, they're just, if there is no joy in what you're doing, if you're agitated and frustrated and you dread going to work and you have that pit of your stomach kind of stuff going on, you can see how that would translate into outcomes, because we've seen it in all kinds of other things and other sectors, airline pilots. So I was not surprised, but again, it's taking that anecdotal evidence and quantifying it, anecdotal knowledge, and quantifying it into evidence so that we can show hospitals, you have got to nurture and love on your nurses, it's going to affect your income in the end, because hospital-acquired infections are not covered anymore. They're not paid for. So we're back to that other pink elephant in the room, staffing and nurse burnout.
Well, and the interesting thing the study found was when they extrapolated it out to the state of Pennsylvania, just the infections, not all the other negative outcomes that could happen, but just the infections cost the state of – they could save the state of Pennsylvania's hospitals $41 million a year in treating those hospital-acquired infections by reducing the burnout rate of nurses from 30% down to 10%. Not getting rid of burnout, just improving things to the point that not as many nurses are burned out.
It's just such a small change they need to make to do that. And we know the evidence is there about why nurses get burnout. It's not just how much they're working. It's about morale, autonomy, how they're treated, if they're treated like professionals, if they're brought to the table, if they feel like they're actually contributing, they're not just coming in and following a list of orders. We know that all of those things help curb burnout.
Kelly, do you buy the number that they use in this study? I'm sure they're backing it up, but do you buy that there's 30% of all the on average, 30% of all nurses are quote unquote burned out?
Yes.
Okay.
At any given time, yeah, I would agree with
I think it's low. But here's philosophy, wisdom from Kelly Arashin, but my mantra is happy nurses equal happy patients. And when your nurses are disgruntled and burned out and tired and stressed, your patient satisfaction and your physician satisfaction is going to follow suit. And I think that those numbers are probably probably low, and a lot of nurses probably don't answer, or they just give I'm fine. I'm not really that burned out. I'm a little stressed, but it's not bad. So we're probably looking at something that's a little higher than that. I applaud their action because I have some personal feelings about hiring more unlicensed personnel to do skills that require more of more clinical judgment and assessment. I know that there was a hospital before I moved here to Hilton Head. I don't know if they're still in that model, but there was a hospital in Baltimore that followed this model. It was an all-RN hospital, and nurses clamored to work there. They, as a matter of fact, nurses would put their applications in and would be turned away because they never had any openings. Nurses didn't leave. They liked working there. It was team nursing, but it was RNs and RNs working together, and they had great patient satisfaction. They were a magnet hospital. They had great outcomes. And like Terry said, now where you're not getting paid for infections, and starting in October and again in 2013 with the rest of the measures by CMS that are becoming non-reimbursable, there's going to be a whole lot more focus on the financial outcomes with the rest of the complication. You know, any hospital-acquired complication is not going to be reimbursed. And if $41 million is just attributed to infection, that doesn't include readmissions, doesn't include your falls, and all the other assorted issues that are associated with hospital-acquired conditions. So I think it's a great thing. I wish we would do it. I think we would. I think our nurses would be a lot happier because you have a peer, someone who's trained as you are and understands, and can help you look at the patient in the same clinical light as you do. And I see that sometimes even the best CNAs they can't put the pieces together. They may be able to do the task, but they can't put the clinical puzzle pieces and make the connections, or they don't see that. Well, I did the vital signs and the blood glucose testing, but they don't recognize the clinical significance of it because they don't have the training. And that's where sometimes we get into trouble. I think it's a great thing. I think more hospitals should do it.
Yeah. And actually there's a related article here from philly.com, out of Philadelphia, where the University of Pennsylvania is. Hahnemann University Hospital is replacing their less expensive workers with people who are paid more. They're basically removing their CNAs and replacing them with RNs. And the reasoning is that we'll have the hospital CEO is quoted as saying they're going to earn more money, create more loyal staff, and be prepared when the labor market becomes more competitive again for nurses. They want to create that kind of feeling. That $41 million number is just infections, just in the state of Pennsylvania. I can't imagine what that extrapolates out to be for the entire United States. It scares the heck out of me that we don't see more change with the research that seems to be, you know, we talk about this kind of stuff every time we do a show, and yet we still continue to run into the same problem years later. Victoria, what causes that?
I know I bang my head against the wall all the time as I'll put my clinical nurse specialist hat on. You know, I am always looking at innovative ways to try to deliver high quality, safe patient care. And, and it seems like we're trying to do that with less resources, but it doesn't work. You have to spend a little money to deliver that high quality care. And again, I think this is the way to do it. You know, cutting nurses and cutting staffing to these bare bone skeleton crews is not the way to do it because you're putting the patients at risk. You need that skilled expertise at the bedside. And, you know, again, not knocking CNAs. A lot of us started out or had a semester or two of CNAs or being a CNA as we went through nursing school. But it is, you are not a skilled nurse. You don't have the background with the theory, all of that knowledge.
You don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And that's bad, and that's why patients do fall or do, you know, have things happen to them in the morning with, like, blood sugars dropping or, you know, not getting their insulin timely because their blood sugars were so high and the nurse never knew that their blood sugar was 500, you know, and got delayed in delivering insulin to them or whatever the case may be. Things happen. And I really think putting more nurses on the units versus taking them away is would be a big thing in a lot of nurse a lot of hospitals across the country. I'm sure we're not the only four people that believe that, that's for sure.
No. Well, and the reason hospitals did that is so that they could increase the patient load for the nurses by doing that. But, you know, even beyond the hospital, so, you know, the majority of acute care happens within the hospital, but the majority of health care happens mm-hmm. outside of that. It's not revenue generation. So even in the physician's offices, so we've established with a new family practice physician here. I couldn't find a family practice NP who did peds in this county, but that's a whole nother discussion. And there's not a nurse in the office. So whoever gives my child immunizations, do they know what to do if that person has anaphylaxis? When they're ordered to give a breathing treatment to someone who comes in with asthma, or we start IV fluids on someone in the office who's dehydrated to keep them out of the emergency room, when there's no registered nurse in an office, what happens? And I would be interested to hear Victoria's viewpoint on this, because I know that you have had some experience with sending non-licensed personnel out. You know, we're not, the hospital's nice, but there's always someone to back you up. You have some protection, and you don't outside of that.
Yeah, what I'm doing is a little bit different because I'm not doing any kind of one-on-one nursing per se. I'm doing more in the case management type area. I do a lot of things, but that is one of my primary areas. So in case management, a lot of it is very clerical. I mean, we are coordinating appointments. We are getting equipment in place. We are determining what physician specialist to send this particular person to based on the assessment that we did when we met with the patient. So I may go and do an assessment, and I make a plan. And in order to implement that plan, I have used non-licensed people because to me it seemed very clerical in nature. You call up this medical supplier and you get this DME equipment ordered into their facility, or you coordinate this appointment. I've already told you what physician that I need this appointment with. You know, you schedule this appointment with the physician. But what I realized, or what I came to realize rather, is that some of the things that we think are clerical, we actually use our critical thinking as an RN to facilitate that. So, for example, maybe I'm calling a medical supplier about a piece of equipment, all right? Well, I do use that medical equipment expertise. Like, say it's a wheelchair, and I may have to have a seating evaluation. That's not my area. So, yes, I'm going to depend on a seating evaluator to come out and do some kind of seating evaluation for my patient. But a lot of times they just want to know what seems like very generic information. What are they currently in? What's the home environment like? Or what's the diagnosis? Well, this clerical person who doesn't have any medical knowledge other than what they've absorbed from working here or being in the field as a unit secretary or as a receptionist, or I've got one that worked in the dental field. You know, you have people that are working those industries that are used to medical terminology. They may know prefixes and suffixes and be able to kind of figure out what terminology that you're talking about. But when it comes to what seems to me as a very simple question, they only can give you rote information. What can they read in the medical record that they can then regurgitate to that person who's asking the questions? They cannot make the assessment. They didn't make the assessment. They can't use any skill in providing the information. So the information that they are putting to the questioner is very generic in nature and not necessarily conducive to that patient's situation. And they're not recognizing simple, what I would consider mistakes, things that should have been recognized as a problem, they're not picking up that it is a problem. Now, I'm only one person, so I can only do so much in a day, and my business has far expanded over what I can produce. So I have to have additional people in place. Well, I have gone to all kinds of different headhunters and employment agencies and so forth looking for RNs. And even finding a registered nurse with lots of bedside skill, does not mean that they necessarily transfer into case management role either. Case management is very different than doing a procedure, than managing a physician order or making the assessment on a critically ill patient that you're dealing with every day. But rather, when you're in the field, I have a lot of catastrophic patients who have multiple injuries all over their body. If they were in the ER and my ER nurse is stabilizing them, they know what to do. But when it's outpatient and they're no longer in that critical area, but yet they have all of these ongoing complaints, they have a hard time prioritizing what needs to be addressed first, second, and third, and how can we coordinate that in such a way that the patient is at ease with the multitude of appointments that we're sending them to, for example. And it's been a real
Victoria,
problem.
You're getting into an area that we've been discussing too, is in nursing education, and that's the type of education and where that focuses. And yes, we've got to have acute care education in our nurses, but
we've lost our critical thinking skill.
Well, that's because we go in and check mark boxes and only do what we're told.
and I absolutely hate electronic medical records for that very reason. And I've been screaming about this for years. My daughter is in nursing school right now. And when I see the things that she's being taught compared to what I had when I was there, I am scared. I'm literally scared for her to be at the bedside with the lack of skill when they are learning from a book. It's like a bunch of flow sheets and charts and things. It's not teaching them how to use their own brain and how to dig for that information.
Well, I think in general, you know, I agree with the nursing education piece, definitely. But I also think that one of the issues is that once they get out of school, and because of the nurse-patient ratios, they're taskmasters. It doesn't matter if they did have, even if the clinical instructors and the faculty have started that little seed and nurtured that little plant of clinical decision-making and critical thinking, it's squashed the minute they're on the floor, because all of a sudden they're turned into taskmasters because they don't have time to use their brain. They have to, and I don't mean that as a slam. I mean that as all of a sudden they have to juggle all these patients and get all these things done. And like you said, the electronic medical record does not foster critical thinking. It's checking boxes. It's marking things off. They have to do all these tasks by a certain amount of time, and sometimes they can't synthesize and make analysis of all the clinical data that they have on these patients because it's time for the next task.
And it's ironic that you use that term, because I have been using that term for 2 years, 3 years, as I've been looking for other people, and I've been telling these RNs that I'm interviewing, I do not want a taskmaster. I have to have, you're out there by yourself in the field with this person. You have to be able to make that assessment and know what to do on your own. You cannot call me every 2 minutes, because then it doesn't mean no good to have you in the field doing it if you're going to call me and ask me what to do every 10 minutes. I might as well have done it myself.
Well, and Kelly's got an excellent point, and then so we're back to nurse burnout, because I would have RN to BSN students who were just out of school, you know, 3 months, 6 months, and they were charged nursing at night with 9 to 10 patients by themselves and only one or other RN on a med-surg floor in a big hospital. Mm-hmm. And if the medications aren't given within 30 minutes, then that's considered a medication error by CMS, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, the statistics are right now that associate degree nurses stay at the bedside an average of 9 to 12 months after graduation, and bachelor's prepared nurses stay an average of 18 to 24 months. That's it. And then they're gone. And then we have to retrain somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But in this particular article where we're talking about going to all RN, I mean, I'm impressed. I'm very, very impressed to think that they would even do that. I wonder what the kind of ratio that they would have if they're going to have an all RN staff. That is surprising to me. Back when I was at the bedside and we did team nursing, we had a 1-to-5 ratio with no more than 10 to do an assessment on. But we had an LPN that would have 5, an RN that would have 5, and you had an aide that worked with you. And you had those patients and you worked side by side with that aide and the aides were not taking entire halls by themselves. And in fostering that team, we worked very well together, and there was a lot less burnout. When they started making the RNs take much larger numbers, and they started phasing out some of the LPNs and using more aides, and now they're calling them patient techs and patient care techs and all these other things where they're allowing them to do a lot more of the, you know, blood sugar checks and those kinds of things, that they're allowing them to do even some of the medication administration that's being done. That scares me. It scares me not only for the fact that it's my license that is at risk because that person maybe is not suitable to do that particular skill, but also for the fact that I'm not looking at that blood sugar as closely as I would be if I were doing it. I'm not laying eyes on that patient during that blood sugar check to see how they are at the time that I'm checking their blood sugar. I'm not having that conversation with them when I'm in there to do that.
And that's an important point.
And they're doing the tasks without having the rationale, right, or the clinical theory, the didactic or the theory behind what they're doing.
And
nurses shortchange themselves, though. We don't think, and just like I was talking about the patients, I mean the people that I'm hiring, we do not give ourselves credit for what all we observe,
yeah,
and assess just by walking in and speaking to a patient and checking that blood sugar.
We're charting the
blood sugar, but we have forgotten, yeah, all those other observations and assessments that we've done while we were in there doing it.
Yeah. If we had to
break down every single one of those tasks, we would find out that we are much more important than we give ourselves credit for.
We don't actually realize all of the skills we've developed and added in the bedside arena. That, you know, that sixth sense that you walk into a room and look at a patient, you know something's wrong, and that is something that that untrained person, all they're going in there to get is a number.
You know, when you've got the guts to stand up and tell the doctor that they are wrong because you've been with this patient every day and you know that something is going on with them and you are asking for orders to do, you know, to check something else, and the doctor is trying to tell you that he or she knows best, and you're standing on your nursing skill to say differently, that's what I'm afraid is missing. You know, when you're not able to assess that patient and you're not with them near as often as you were in the past, then how do you have the skill to stand up and know that you're going to go up your chain of command to get something done?
Well, that's why I think the whole nursing, having more nursing at the bedside and less of the unassisted or the unlicensed personnel, is going to have to positively affect patient outcomes, because mm-hmm. you'll always have that trained professional, you know, that set of eyes, that clinical professional at the bedside, seeing, you know, the patient, interacting with the patient, using their expertise.
He talks about this in this pilot study, he thinks it's going to earn more money and more customers. I can understand where it would earn more customers, absolutely, once word gets out. I think the staff would be more loyal. But he's thinking it's going to pay off financially as insurance companies change reimbursement to reward quality. I found that very interesting because, you know, all of us who've worked in that hospital, for a hospital CEO to say, oh, we're not going to hire these people at $9 an hour anymore because we're going to go to all these RNs. And then, I mean, I think the all RN staff is great, but what are they going to do for the staffing ratio? Are we really right. going to replace the number of CNAs that they had with RNs? I don't see that happening. I think it may be one RN to every two CNAs or something like that. So I don't know how that's going to work out in the end. I'm interested to see what kind of follow-up.
Right, Victoria, I totally agree. I think the staffing matrix is definitely going to have to be creative. But if you take, even if you take that equation out, I think lowering your infections and complications and acquired hospital-acquired complications, you're bound to improve your finances just in the fact that you're not losing money by CMS because you're not losing all that non-reimbursable care.
The article has the numbers in there. The hospital has 600 registered nurses. Then they talk about 75 CNAs that will likely lose their jobs. And the hospital is looking to hire 50 to 60 more nurses to replace 75 CNAs. So not 2-to-1, probably about 2/3, fewer personnel. But if they're critical thinking personnel, you would like to think that that's going to turn into a better quality patient care.
$25 an hour? Where is this?
I know. Oh my.
Philadelphia.
Holy smokes. Oh, that's crazy. Oh, well, CNA's their union. That's why. Our CNAs make like minimum wage here, $7.75 to like $9.
Now you start getting into the Northeast, and it's there's a lot of unions, both for nurses and for other workers in the hospital, and that's what drives up the price of things there. So the nurses make more too, but they're also driving into the center of Philly and paying for parking and everything else that deals with that, and long commutes. So a lot of the city hospitals pay more just because they can't get people to come in there and work. So I think we're getting on the end of the call here, and it's been a great discussion. I love it when I start the discussion and then I hardly get to talk the rest of the episode. That's kind of the purpose of the show.
We ganged up on you today.
I'm not feeling bad about it. This is what I intend the show to do every time we get on. I think it's great that this topic took off, because I think it's one that we're going to keep revisiting as the fallout from this study continues to go, and other other hospitals start to make decisions based upon it, and other nurses start to do more research around it to try to identify, because one of the things I look for is we now know that there's a why. Why is nurse staffing tied to poor patient outcomes? But the next question is, what can we do to improve the burnout situation? Staffing cannot be the only answer. And it is an answer. It's an obvious answer. But I suspect that they're going to have to find other things, because not every hospital is going to be able to fulfill all their staffing requirements. And so they're going to have to find other things that can improve care. So we'll talk about this in the future. Before we get out of here, I want to just go through and tell everybody where they can be found. So Victoria, where can folks find out more about what you're up to?
Well, my website is vp-medical.com, and all of my links to LinkedIn and Twitter and so forth are all there. I write a blog on some interesting medical legal issues, and I'm available online most all day, every day.
Yeah, and I have to say, your site's different than the last time I was there. It really looks great.
Thank you.
Did a redesign?
I've done some work on it. We launched before everything was completely done, but that's because I'm a picky about photographs and stuff, and we're still working with the photographer to get some photographs of everybody. We're all women, so you know how it is.
It has to
be
just so.
We always want to look our very best before we start posting that out there for the world.
It's going to be like Housewives of VP Medical?
Exactly.
That's another topic, right, for those YouTube clips about nurses.
Oh, yeah. We didn't get to that, but I'm going to save that one for a time Kim McAllister's on here. I'm sure she'll have some loud and vociferous complaints. Well, Victoria, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And Terry, where can folks find you?
I'm on Twitter at Online Nursing, and my blog is nursestory.com, and both Victoria and Kelly's sites are so cool. I want to be more like them.
Oh. Thank you.
And Kelly, you're last so but funny. Not least, go ahead. Where can folks find you, the Barefoot Nurse?
You can find me on barefootnurse.blogspot.com. And you can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com Barefoot Nurse Blog, and Twitter, KellRN24 or Barefoot Nurse, either one.
And guess what? We'll have links to all that in the show notes for this episode, so everybody can check all that out there. So I'm Jamie Davis. You can find me over at insightsinnursing.com, and of course on my other shows, primarily for nurses, over at nursingshow.com. But you can certainly find all the information, links to everything we discussed, and additional links to the speakers, the panelists, all over at insightsinnursing.com for this episode. And if you want to get back in touch with us or want to contact one of the panelists from today's episode, send those emails in to nursing, insights in nursing. I got too many email addresses. insightsinnursing@gmail.com. And we'll go ahead and connect you back with folks if you have a specific question, if I can't answer it. And I love to hear from you. And I know the rest of the panelists all love to hear from the audience. So get in touch with us and let us know what you think about the discussions in this episode. That's it for us. We're going to be back soon with another episode here of Insights in Nursing. And in the meantime, remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to Insights in Nursing.